Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. And you know what? Your support makes this possible. Thanks.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Well, good morning. So great to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio Network. If you are in your 40s or approaching 40, have you ever felt like you're having a midlife crisis? You know, the psalmist tells us to number our days in order to gain wisdom. Solomon says, life is but a vapor, and all of our striving for success is vanity. Yikes! Doesn't sound too optimistic. But today we're going to be talking to a Christian leader who believes that we can see the middle of life as an opportunity rather than a crisis. Stick with us. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Peter Greer, the co-author of the book 40-40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. Even if you're not in your 40s or 50s, I think you'll find this incredibly valuable. And, you know, if you know somebody who, let's say, is approaching the big 4-0, let's say they're in their late 30s and they're kind of reevaluating their life, I'd encourage you, give them a call. And they can tune in for the next 45 minutes or so, because they're going to hear some great information, I think, that they can apply to their daily life and certainly to their Christian walk. So give them a buzz. Tell them to tune in to Faith Radio here for the remainder of this hour. First up this morning, are you hooked on your smartphone? If so, could it actually be making you unhappy? New survey was out, and it asked younger Americans how they feel about their relationship with their smartphone, and it turns out they're quite conflicted. In fact, 9 out of 10 younger millennials, ages 18 to 24, say they check their phones at least once an hour, if not constantly. I think constantly is probably the truth there. And now a new survey is out that found that 50% of younger Americans say they think they'd be happier if they use their phone less often. The survey was done by the Harris Polling Organization. They also found that younger Americans, again, probably 20s, 30s, tend to sleep with their phones next to them in bed. Is that you? 80% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 34, admit to using their smartphones in the bathroom. 90% of millennials in this Harris poll said that over the next decade, the internet is going to provide them with more access to the jobs they're suited for. But, get this, 83% of them worry that if they don't keep up with the latest technology, they'll be less employable. And here's a finding that I found particularly interesting. While 88% of millennials say that technology has brought them closer to friends and relatives who live far away, less than half say it will allow them to maintain closer relationships. In fact, 3 out of 4 younger Americans say that in 10 years, relationships will be less authentic because of our reliance on digital communication. Wow. So even though many Americans, especially younger Americans, say they're hooked to their smartphones and to their devices, they admit that maybe it's interfering with real relationships. I talked before quite a bit about the fact that, you know, things like the nonverbals, eye contact, facial expressions, body language, they are so key to personal relationships and certainly to intimacy, to vulnerability, authenticity in a relationship. And you just don't get that with high-tech forms of communication. So a big concern. And, you know, it probably doesn't help when you think about this, that millennials are really the worst offenders when it comes to things like texting at meals, checking their phones in the middle of conversations, and they're most likely to be people that will break up by text message. Yes, even tell their their spouse that they want to file for divorce through texting. Just stunning to me. But that's the world we live in. Okay, if you're a mom or dad, do you ever read parenting magazines? You know, if you're like me, sometimes you'll flip through a parenting magazine, getting your hair cut, or maybe at the pediatrician's office. Well, those magazines, if you've read any of them, you know, Parenting, Parents, they're filled with lots of heartwarming images of kids smiling and playing and snuggling with their mom and dad and snuggling with puppies, typically in the advertisements. But did you know that a lot of those ads in the major parenting magazines are showing kids doing things that are dangerous? Yes, a new study has found that ads in two of the top-selling parenting magazines contain photos or promote products that could be considered unsafe for a child's health. For example, an ad might show a photograph of young kids in a boat, and they aren't wearing life jackets. Oops. Or an ad might show babies in their cribs sleeping on their stomachs or their sides, not on their backs, which is recommended to lower the risk of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. Dr. Michael Pitt is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. He says it was surprising that about every sixth ad in these parenting magazines had at least one violation of the American Academy of Pediatrics policies. Can you believe it? One magazine had an ad showing children riding bicycles, smiling without helmets. Riding the bikes with no helmets. Another showed a toddler reaching into a bag of popcorn, which, as you may know, that's something that should be avoided by children under age 5 because it's a possible choking hazard. The researchers say they're concerned because when parents see these photos in a glossy magazine, it may send the message that, well, that behavior is normal, when in reality it can be risky or even dangerous. So try that experiment for yourself. Next time you're in the pediatrician's office and you pick up a parenting magazine, start looking through the ads and see how many you could find where the kids are doing things that are dangerous. Hopefully not, walking along the rim of a live volcano or, bungee jumping, but just check that out for yourself. Well, it's 12 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer. Coming up next, we tackle the topic of midlife with Peter Greer, the author, co-author of 40-40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. If you're approaching 40 or in your 40s or 50s, stick around because I know Peter's going to have some information that you will find helpful and also, I think, contribute to your spiritual growth. That's up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
I want to say hi to our friends who are listening on Faith 90.5 in Duluth. Appreciate you joining us today. Also, if you're listening on Faith 1200 in the Fargo-Moorhead area, or perhaps on Faith 1270 in Sioux Falls, we appreciate you making Faith Radio part of your weekend. You can find the entire weekend schedule and the weekday schedule by going to myfaithradio.com. You'll also find some great articles there that will help you, I believe, grow as a Christian and learn how to share your faith more effectively and learn what it really means to serve Christ in the 21st century. So check it out, myfaithradio.com. Well, our guest today is Peter Greer. He's the president and CEO of Hope International, a global Christ-centered microfinance organization which is serving throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. Peter is an advocate for the church's role in missions and for alleviating extreme poverty around the world. He's been a featured speaker at many conferences, including Catalyst, Passion, Jubilee, and Harvest International's Development Conference. He's also been featured in Christianity Today, World, Forbes, Relevant, and Outcomes magazine, and he's been on CNN. He's co-authored a bunch of books, including The Poor Will Be Glad, The Spiritual Danger of Doing Good, Mission Drift, Entrepreneurship for Human Flourishing, Stop Helping Us, and Watching Seeds Grow. And today, he joins us to talk about the new book that he co-authored with Pastor Greg Lafferty, called 40-40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. And Peter, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you live in a beautiful area of the country, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I had a chance to travel to your neck of the woods a couple of years ago. First of all, I was blown away by the beauty, but also, you'll find this interesting, I had a chance to speak to a group of about 50 Amish parents. You're probably familiar with Auntie Ann from Auntie Ann's Pretzels.
I certainly am, not just her, but also her pretzels. Yes, very
At her pretzels. And so I was in Lancaster County speaking to these wonderful Amish families who actually arrived in buggies, and I'm sure that's something that you see every day on the roads around Lancaster.
You know, I grew up in Boston, and there we had all kinds of traffic problems. And moving to Lancaster, there is not a traffic problem, except sometimes when an Amish buggy is going maybe a little too slow there. So that's a traffic jam around here. But it is a wonderful part of the country, and I'm sorry I missed you when you were here in the hometown.
It was really, really fun, really a blessing, and I had a chance to have lunch with an Amish family on their farm and even drive the buggy, so that was really a kick. Well, you've been involved with microfinance for a number of years, and before we talk about your book, I'd love to just inform our listeners a little bit, because this is really a unique approach to helping the poor around the world. I have a friend that worked for another organization that did microfinance loans in Kenya in the slums of Mathari. Tell us a little bit about this entire type of program to help poor people in developing countries.
Yeah, well, it's been really interesting over the last couple decades that I think there have been a couple different stages of how we think about helping people in need. And initially, maybe it was on a short-term mission trip, or maybe it was some images that we saw on the television about a disaster. But I love that followers of Jesus, there's an unbroken chain from the time of Jesus to today of people that say, when confronted with significant need, we've got to do something. We've got to show the love and share the love with people that are going through a tough time. And so that was kind of the founding story of Hope. It was really born out of helping after the fall of the Soviet Union. But again, after you go on enough mission trips, after you try helping, eventually you come to this conclusion that sometimes our help doesn't really seem like it's making a lasting difference. We give food away, and then the food is eaten, and then people are still in the same spot. Or we build a house, and then the house falls into disrepair. We build a church, and it doesn't ever seem like it's really owned by the local community. And so eventually we say, how do we go beyond a handout? How do we go to a hand up? And I think that's really where the church is right now. And I think it's an exciting time to say, how do we help the church globally to really take care of their own needs, to have a long-term solution to some of these problems that we care about? And so microfinance, I think it's really a terrible word for what it actually is, but it's really helping individuals start small businesses so they can take care of their own needs, so they can tie it to their own churches, and they can take care of, again, not just their families, but really to see flourishing happen in the places that we are. So it starts with saving services, it starts with coaching, it starts with mentoring, but then it also gets into access to capital, to small loans, to expand a business. And for us, the model has discipleship and church partnership at the very core of how we do it. So the shorthand way is it's really trying to transition beyond short-term relief and really equip families around the world to take care of their own needs by having the gift of work, the gift of a job, and growing in their faith.
Okay, so give us an example. Tell us a story about one of the individuals that you have helped with microfinance loans in one of these countries, because that I think that will help flesh it out for the person that's not familiar with this type of program.
There are so many. Hope as a organization partners around the world, so we're currently serving 800,000 families, but you're exactly right. It's the power of just one story. So, just a couple weeks ago, I was down in a Haitian community, a Bate, and just incredible poverty. But one of the individuals that we met was a man named Valentino, and he had a business where he had an interest in bees. And so initially he had a couple hives, and he continued to learn about bees. And then he partnered with our partner Esperanza and ended up getting the capital to grow his business. And so when I was with him, there were bees swarming all around us. He had the smoker that he said this smoke pacifies the bees, but the bees didn't really seem that pacified. But they were all around us, and he showed us his 33 hives. So from just a little bit, just three hives, he now had expanded to 33 hives. And it's not just, again, it's not just a business story, but that allows him to dream even bigger dreams. It allows him to take care of his family. And with so many entrepreneurs, it allows them to see and know and experience in a relationship that someone is coming into that community, serving them, and sharing the hope of Christ. And so whether it's bees, whether it's honey production, or whether it was Anasita Zia, a blind Rwandan widow that I was with in Rwanda, and how she built onto her home so she could rent out rooms as a way of taking care of her family. And her comment to me was, "I may behold, I may be blind, but I will not beg, and I will provide for my family." And just the dignity that there was there, it just, you don't have people with their head down and their hand up. You see people that stand tall, knowing that God has given them gifts and abilities, and they have the joy of providing for their family. So, I probably should stop there, though, but there's a lot of wonderful stories from around the world.
So these are individuals who have some kind of interest in some sort of business or some talent or ability or experience, and they just don't have the money to get started. So through donations from people who live in the developed world, maybe right here in the United States, you make the capital, you make the loans available to these individuals. And then I don't know if your organization works this way. Do you have these loan accountability groups? And tell us about the what's I find fascinating about micro enterprise loans is that the rate, the number of people who actually stick to their payments, and it's a small amount of interest they pay back, but of course allows you to make more loans, that really there's very few people that default on their loans. They, if they're working hard and they're achieving in their business, they're paying you back. Is that correct?
You're exactly right. You are a great spokesperson for microfinance. Yeah, you get it. You totally do. And it is amazing. So Hope, just as one example, over the last 5 years, we have had 98% of all the loans that we've made repaid. And so it just is incredible that many people – I was in Massachusetts one time, and I had a banker come up to me, and he said, "Peter, I just don't believe it. I don't believe if you're telling me you work in places of extreme poverty and you make loans $100, $200, $300, $400, and you get they're uncollateralized and you get 98% of them repaid. I don't believe that. I want to see your books." And so we showed him our books. And more than that, we showed him the reason for this is because we empower local communities to be their own committee to decide who gets access to capital. And so you're exactly right. It's a group of people that come together. And if someone doesn't repay the loan, then it's the other group members that decide that they will pitch in to cover that individual. And so it really is this sense of community, and it works in an incredible way. And, you know, the more powerful thing on that is it's not just that then there's this group that's going to come alongside you. It also is a screening mechanism that only people that really have the right character, that have the right work ethic, that have the right business idea, as judged by that local community, those are the ones that are going to access the capital. And then the second piece is if something starts happening in my business, I've got, you know, 29 other individuals from my community that say, "We've got to help Peter because we don't want his business to go south." And so it really strengthens the sense of community as they work together.
It's very different from the old model of, as you said, just giving a handout, just going into a community and, you know, building buildings or just, you know, providing people with food. Not that those are bad things, but correct me if I'm wrong. More and more research, as we look into global development, poverty alleviation, it seems that those old methods, at least in certain cultures, are not working.
You know, I heard a friend from Haiti share recently. He said, you know, there's something wrong if the way that aid is done, there's something wrong if the goal of the aid organizations is to never help us become independent of it. And so I think there is this sense of if there's an organization that is still doing the same thing in the same way in a relief model year after year, decade after decade, the question is why? Why hasn't anything changed in that community? And so I really think the highest form of our charity is when people become independent of the need for it. The highest goal is not that we still feel good about our ability to help others, but that individuals that we maybe at one time were helping, that they now are independent of our aid and that they have the joy of giving in the local community. And they know, they've experienced the joy of generosity and that it is more blessed to give than receive. And I just think we need to come to a point where relief is appropriately applied in the wake of a natural disaster. But as soon as the news cameras leave, the question is the community going to be any better off than they were before? And I don't think you can have that discussion without recognizing rule of law matters. But more than that, we've got to help people help themselves. We've got to help them become independent of their need for charity. And as great as there's so many good organizations doing good work, I just hope that we come to a point where we actually can visit some communities and say, you know what, we can move on because there no longer is a need for the form of relief that at one point was really helpful to that community. Just last example of that is Hope International started in that form of short-term relief, and it was a pastor in Ukraine that said, your help isn't helping us. And he just recognized that it was creating dependency and entitlement. And I just believe that, again, the goal of charity is to make someone independent of the need for it.
And certainly from a biblical perspective, God talks about the value of work and the importance of a work ethic. And we find, because of the way we're created, we find often our dignity and our value partially, not of course totally, but partially through the work that we do and actually accomplishing something. So it's a very biblical model. Our guest is Peter Greer, and he is the co-author of the book 40/40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. We're going to dive into Peter's book here in just a bit. And he co-authored the book with a local pastor from the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. And we'll be checking into that book and finding out how it might apply to your life or the life of someone you know in just a bit here on the Faith Radio Network.
Right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. So great to have you with us today. My guest is Peter Greer. He's the co-author of 40/40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. And you probably know I'm a big Andy Stanley fan, senior pastor of North Point in the Atlanta area. Here's what Andy Stanley says about this book. Midlife can be a dangerous and disappointing time. In 40/40 Vision, Greg and Peter do a fantastic job leveraging lessons from Ecclesiastes to help those of us in this critical season find purpose and satisfaction. Some pretty nice words there, Peter, from Andy Stanley.
They sure were. We have been really thankful for our partnership with his church, and it was very gracious of him to provide the endorsement for the book as well.
So in Ecclesiastes, Solomon pretty much comes to the end of his rope. He realizes that, you know, he's been striving. He's the wealthiest man in the world. He has, I don't know, a couple thousand wives. I can't remember the exact count, but he's got everything that anyone could ever want and more. And yet he says, he comes to the point where he says, all is vanity. It's all meaningless. And we're just a vapor, which isn't really a very optimistic thought, but we can certainly learn from that, can't we?
I think we can. And I don't think you're the only one who didn't know how many wives he had. I don't think he knew how many wives he had at that point either. And, you know, it is really interesting, isn't it? If the most successful if the wealthiest person, if someone who had achieved everything that that this world says is going to bring meaning and satisfaction, if we could sit down with someone who had achieved all of that, who had every exploit, every adventure, everything, every conquest, everything that we could possibly think would bring meaning and satisfaction, wouldn't it be fascinating if we could sit down and say, so tell me about it. Like, what's the answer? You've done everything. What really brings meaning and happiness? Tell me, what is most important? Maybe for some of us, it would be, you know, sitting down with someone like Bill Gates, and he can do anything that money can buy. What's the best thing you've ever experienced? And that's this crazy book in the Bible of Ecclesiastes, is we get to sit down and we get to learn someone who had accomplished everything and more that we could dream of, and get to learn from that person's perspective. So what's the point of it all? What really makes us happy? And isn't it possible that we would learn from that person's experience to say, if that is the end, I don't want to spend my life on things that, you know, maybe they've experienced and maybe didn't make that much of an impact. And so I think that's really the incredible invitation, is to say, let's learn from someone who experienced it all, and at the end of it says, you know what, it doesn't really provide the advertised enjoyment, and maybe that conclusion by someone at the end of the life might help us live differently today as a result.
And of course, it's especially meaningful to those who are approaching midlife. Maybe they're in their late 30s, maybe their 40s or 50s, and they're asking themselves these questions. I'm wondering, what inspired you and Greg Lafferty to tackle this topic? Was it the fact that you're both kind of in that stage of life yourselves?
Yeah, and you know, it really is quite an interesting premise, right? Let's talk about midlife, and let's talk about the book of Ecclesiastes, whose conclusion seems to be everything's meaningless. Isn't that a happy, cheery thing to spend several years thinking about and writing on? I mean, it just sounds dreadful, but hopefully in the writing and the way that we treat it, we really can have a hopeful and enjoyable conversation about things that really are weighty and really do matter. But yeah, so Greg, he has been a friend, a board member. He is a pastor, someone whom I deeply respect. And the thing that I respect perhaps most about Greg is he brings humor into everything, but he also brings honesty into the conversation. And I don't think many people are honest with this season. I don't think many people are honest with the challenges. I don't think many people are honest with the struggles. And so we kind of settle for some sort of a veneer of everything is awesome, everything's fine, when the reality, and actually empirically, this is a turbulent time. There was a study that was covered in The Atlantic. It was also covered in The Economist. But we looked at this research that showed how life satisfaction declines in the 20s and 30s, and it bottoms out in the 40s. And that's not just in the U.S. That's a global phenomenon, that literally in 55 of 80 countries where a similar survey was administered, they found that midlife had the least satisfaction, the least satisfied people globally. And kind of, if you want to know if you're in the danger zone, they found that the global low point, if you just have to have one point where kind of the life satisfaction hits bottom, it's age 46, when earning actually is reaching its peak. And so there's something happening here where life satisfaction is declining at a time where wealth and career and family are all expanding. And so, yeah, I wanted to make sure that I'm prepared. I don't want to be one of these unprepared people as I walk through this season of life. And Greg very graciously spent a long time thinking through these topics. And I really hope the book helps people be prepared for this season that oftentimes is marked by turbulence.
Now, Greg, I think, is in his 50s. Did he go through this himself? I know he's worked as a pastor in many large, many mega churches around the country and served in various leadership positions. Did he personally go through that?
Yes, and I really appreciate some of the stories that he shares in here are some of the issues that he faced that are not unique to him and are not unique to a lot of listeners right now as well. This is a turbulent time, and you know, maybe some of us think about the midlife crisis in terms of a cliche of the sports car, maybe as a male phenomenon, but the data suggests that this is for men and women. Actually, a higher percentage of women reported a turbulent time during these times. And so, again, Greg and I, hopefully with humor, but also with honesty, look at some of the most important questions that you need to answer during this life. And if they are not answered, they will demand to be answered in other ways that oftentimes causes a lot of harm. Oftentimes you see rational people acting incredibly irrationally during this turbulent season.
All right, let's take a look at some of those questions that we need to answer. And again, even if you're not in your 40s or 50s, even if you're in your 30s or you've passed those years, maybe you have a friend or relative, maybe even a son or daughter who is approaching the 40s, let's jump into some of those most important, most significant questions that we need to answer, and then how they really are answered through Scripture and through God's perspective on how we are to live a wise, fruitful life.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the pieces that just, again, I can just say personally, I have been changed by thinking about this subject. And the first thing is that we need to realize that this life really is short. And perhaps so much of our life, it's the sense of looking forward, looking forward, looking forward. Life will really start when ... Life will really start when I get that promotion, that dream job. Or life will really start when I can own my home. Or life will really start when I can have kids. Or life will really start when I can be a grandparent. And then suddenly you realize that time is passing by so quickly. And so that's, you know, the title 40-40 Vision. All of us come to this point where we realize, wait a minute, life is not, life on this earth is short. And how do we deal with that? You know, there are some that go to the, well, if life is short, let's do everything we can to fill it, maximize pleasure. Let's do everything we can. And if I'm not happy, then I'm going to make some changes. So there's something about pleasure that we need to deal with. There's something about looking at our mortality in the eyes. And the person who came up with the term midlife crisis was a Canadian named Elliot Jock, and he talks about, he was the first person to coin the term midlife crisis in 1965. And it's interesting because he said a midlife crisis is caused when we're forced to look at our mortality in the eye for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's a personal kind of physical breakdown, maybe it's our first, or maybe it's watching our parents have their last, maybe it is something that in terms of this experience with death, with maybe someone that we know, someone that we love, that maybe causes us to think differently. But all of us, again, have to come to this point where we realize life is short. And hopefully that doesn't leave us in a spot of just, you know, chasing, you know, new pleasure after new pleasure. Maybe we can stop that and say, if life is short, how do I live differently as a result? We have one person that said, you know, I make sure that every year it's good for my soul to go to a wedding and a funeral every year. A wedding to remember the vow that I made in its sacredness, and a funeral to remember that that is where we all end, and how do we live differently as a result?
You know, it seems like the two negative responses, and there may be more than these, but it seems like the two kind of broad responses to this kind of crisis. One is, as you said, the search for more pleasure. I call it the Coors party ball existence, where it's all about, and I think really what is at the heart of that is trying to cover up maybe the fear of the fact that, you know, this life is going to end. And so I'm just going to self-medicate myself. Whether it's through, drugs or alcohol or sexuality or experiences, you know, the adventure travel, you know, you could name a bunch of them, that people are just trying to bury these things that Solomon says so clearly in Ecclesiastes that all of us have to deal with. So that's one extreme. The other extreme, I think, is despair. It's depression. It's reaching that existential crisis and saying, oh my gosh, in 30 years, 40 years, I'm going to be gone. And all of this stuff that I've been trying to build for myself, you know, I'm successful in my work, and I've got the, you know, the boat, and I've got the summer home, and, you know, on and on and on. And yet, what does it all mean? And It seems like those are kind of two of the more, I guess, negative or dysfunctional responses. So what is the correct response? I mean, Solomon says, in the end, he says it's to fear God and, you know, keep his precepts, to honor his commandments. How does that play out in this 21st century world?
Bill, that is such a good point. You know, pleasure and despair, we might think of them as the two logical conclusions of this whole conversation. And yet one of the things that we've become convinced of is actually pleasure and despair are more closely aligned than we might initially think. Because pleasure, right, there's so much to enjoy in this world. And there are these moments of just great enjoyment. You know, this morning I got to play with my kids. I got to smell bacon. And, you know, like, there's just fun things in life. And yet the thing about them that is just kind of so maddening is pleasure. It's ever-present. And it's ever fleeting, right? It seems like the moment that we have this moment of pleasure, it just slips through our fingers. It's so short. And so when we're young, you know, we assume that the bigger kicks are going to come later. And yet there seems to be this diminishing law, not an increasing. And so oftentimes pleasure then, when we achieve what we thought was going to bring satisfaction, when we thought we'd have that ultimate thing that would really satisfy it, maybe for some, you know, Cubs fan, it was when the Cubs finally win, maybe, you know, then I'm going to be happy. Or whatever it is, that promotion, that stage of life. And so we spend all of our life chasing pleasure. But then if we get it, and in some ways I feel like if we're unfortunate enough to get it, if we get what we were chasing for so long and it doesn't do what we thought it was going to do, that leads to a place of despair. And so I believe God tends to be most active, or that's probably the wrong way of saying it. I believe we are most attentive to what God wants to do in our lives in moments where the world seems like it's falling apart and we have nowhere to go but on our knees and cry out, when we're in that slimy pit, or when we have achieved what we thought would bring satisfaction, and the real tough times in life are oftentimes despair, or perhaps more unlikely, they're in those moments where we caught what we were chasing for so long and we realize, you know what, that too, it's just so temporary. And again, this is the brilliance of King Solomon and the writing in Ecclesiastes. He writes in chapter 2, he says, "Come, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But this also proved to be meaningless." But then he talks about this. He says, "I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens." And so he went after pleasure, and he went after it hard, and he ended up in that place of despair. And so maybe the gift of this time in life, maybe the gift of whatever you want to define midlife as, is if you've caught some of the things that you've been chasing, and they didn't really do what you thought they were going to do, maybe you can let go as that as the place of that pursuit as what is going to bring ultimate meaning and satisfaction to your life.
All right, we're going to dive into how we find ultimate meaning and satisfaction after we take a quick break. My guest, Peter Greer, the co-author of 40/40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. Stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. My guest is Peter Greer. He's the president and CEO of Hope International, which is a global Christ-centered microfinance organization serving throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. He's also co-author of this brand new book, 40/40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. He wrote it with his friend, a local pastor from his area, named Greg Lafferty, who's also on Peter's board at his organization. And as you guys wrote this book, one of the things you did, and we've talked about really this crisis that many of us go through in midlife, where We are seeking after an accomplishment, achievement, pleasure, and we realize, we come to a point, realize, as Solomon did, that, you know, all is vanity and we're but a vapor, and we've got another, you know, maybe if we're lucky, 40, 50 years on this earth. And that might be pushing it for some people, depending on their health. But you talk about some positive ways to respond and those that have done it well. So let's, in the just remaining 10 minutes or so that we have, let's offer what you and Greg really believe is the solution to this, which is really based on what Solomon says at the close of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is just the one of the most powerful conclusions of any book in the Bible. And after going through all these things, again, everything that we might believe would lead us to satisfaction, one of these things that might finally cause us to have this happiness that we crave, and just one issue after another, and we say, that's not it, that's not it, that's not it. Eventually, he does come to the conclusion, and he states it in a pretty emphatic way. He says, now all has been heard. And he did his homework. He spent a lifetime doing his homework about what brings meaning and satisfaction. And he says, here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. That's a pretty powerful conclusion. And I think eventually that is what we eventually look for. It's as C.S. Lewis said, you know, if we eventually, if we find that the happiness of this world does not ultimately satisfy, maybe that is just because we weren't created ultimately for this world. Maybe there's something that is a deeper longing, this longing that I believe is ultimately met when we have a restored relationship with our Creator. And so I think that, again, midlife, this is not some depressing topic. I think it actually can be a freeing topic to say, if we're not going to find meaning and satisfaction in more stuff or more experiences, then maybe it's possible to be free from those pursuits and to say, I want to fear God. I want to keep his commands. I want to live with a bold faith and a reckless abandon for things that do ultimately matter. I want to love people that are around me really well. I want to boldly share the hope that we have in Christ, and to be free of some of these trivial pursuits that end up maybe just not doing it. So again, that's why I see this as a gift. This time of life really can be a recalibration. It's a time of life. We're talking about midlife. So there still are years left, and it can maybe be a time to see clearly what matters and then live passionately for that.
Now, these are some big, bold ideas. And again, I think we need to sometimes take the 30,000 foot level when we're examining our midlife or any part of our life. But let's just talk about a few practicals on how we would walk this out. Obviously, fearing God and keeping his commandments is at the core. How does that look, though, just from, okay, tomorrow morning when I wake up? what are some ways that maybe you and Greg would say we can start on this new journey? Maybe we've sort of been ignoring it, this importance of fearing God and keeping his commandments, and, you know, looking at what's most matters most in life. Tomorrow morning when I wake up, what are some things that I can do to start on this new journey? And I hate New Year's resolutions, but let's just say if you and Greg were sitting down with someone and they said, okay, well, how do I do it? And I know that's probably oversimplifying things, but maybe just a few practical ideas on how we might get started if we're realizing we're in that stuck place.
Yeah, Bill, I'm a little bit reluctant to kind of give kind of the broad without knowing situations, but I can tell you tomorrow morning when I wake up what I'm going to do differently as a result of spending time thinking through this. And again, we hope the book is a prompt for people to enter into discussion together and answer this question for themselves. But a couple things, a couple practical and then a couple perhaps maybe some bigger picture. But one of the practical ones is tomorrow I'm going to take a marble out of my jar. And so this was a friend who suggested this, and I think it's so powerful. But he said, look at the average life expectancy, have a certain number of marbles, and every week, the beginning of a week, take one of those marbles out as a physical reminder of the brevity of life. And so, again, maybe that's depressing, but I find it terribly freeing to actually remember, to count our days, to number our days, and then to live differently. Second thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to actually be okay to rest Even though life is short, I believe that one of the things that God created us with is this idea of resting and remembering that God loves this world more than we do, and so we can rest. And so tomorrow is, for me, a day of rest. And third thing is I'm going to spend more time in real relationships and less time on social media. I want to have the real friends. There was a really interesting kind of piece that we found, a guy named David Brooks, who wrote a story about eulogy virtues versus resume virtues. And so hopefully tomorrow I'm going to live based on eulogy virtues instead of resume virtues. And what that practically means is that when you listen to a eulogy, when you listen to someone, they're not talking about the career, they're not talking about the titles, they're talking about the simple acts of kindness, the simple acts of love, the conversations of weight and consequence, and they're not about these things. And so tomorrow, I hope as I wake up, I'm going to be more focused on not building a resume, but living the virtues with people that are right around me that seem to matter most. I hope that my wife is going to know that she is loved and cherished tomorrow more than any other, and knowing that she is the one that apart from my relationship with God, she is the one that I'm going to have the joy of living and loving and serving alongside for this life. And so I'm not going to let work or interruptions or other pursuits mean that I miss an opportunity to love her and these kids. And anyway, so it changes the way that I think about family. It changes the way that I think about work. It changes the way that I spend my time. And again, all of this, I have come to the conclusion, along with Solomon, that I just don't want to get to the end of my life to think about what really matters. I want to think about them today so that I can live differently as a result.
You said a couple of things there which I think are so critical in this day and age, and I've spent quite a bit of airtime on this program sort of lamenting the fact that so many Christians are tethered to their devices. So many Christians are caught up in this whole social media comparison game. So many Christians are really addicted to their smartphone. And I don't know, Peter, I have to believe this perhaps is a tool of Satan to keep us from what's really important in life, and perhaps even keeping us from some of these issues that we're talking about. It's talk about all is vanity. I mean, Facebook, come on, let's be real here. And again, I'm not saying that all this stuff, there are some positives to being connected with people we haven't seen for a long time and people across the country and, you know, grandparents and grandkids connecting through, you know, technology. But your perspective on that, do you think that's perhaps keeping some of us from grappling with these issues? We've only got about a minute left, but what do you think?
Yeah, Bill, I've appreciated your show and the way that you've spoken about this. And I think you're right. I think one of the most dangerous pieces is this idea of comparison and how it robs joy. And so we compare ourselves to images that are kind of social media avatars that don't even reflect real life. And so I think, you know, there's this element of fasting, and I think it is helpful. Break any addiction. And if it's an addiction that is causing you not to love the people that are right around you, it's time to break that addiction. And I think, again, thinking about the end of life, it's not your Facebook friends that are going to be there. It is your real friends you've invested in real life on life together with them that are going to be there with you.
Great thoughts. Peter Greer, 4040 Vision, clarifying your mission in midlife here on the Faith Radio Network. Thanks so much for listening today. Programming like this is made available through your support. You can find information at myfaithradio.com.